community today again, and we're going to talk about white privilege, and the resolution will be that substantial legal remedies should be adopted to compensate for white privilege. To your right is Aaron Fishbone and Peter Winfield, who will be adjourning the resolution. And to your left is Anthony Payton and Helen Morgan, who will be mediating the resolution. So welcome and enjoy the debate. There will be questions after.
I didn't even know what it was until last year when I did a lot of research on the topic. And even doing all that research, I didn't understand what it was for a long time. Because if it is what it's made out to be, then I didn't feel there was any way to get around it. White privilege is a system whereby many of us who are the dominant members of society, white people, have special unearned privileges because of our dominant role in society. That means that we get unearned advantages because of the color of our skin. We're not seen as an other. We're given advantages in education and in career moves, and we're made to live in neighborhoods that are very safe because of our economic situation as well. We're able to live in many of us are able to live in neighborhoods where it's very safe and where there's a predominantly white community. In order to help you understand white privilege, there was an article written by Peggy McIntosh, who's a women's studies scholar at Wesley College, and in 1988 she wrote this. I've come to see white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets that I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible weightless knapsack, special provisions, insurances, duples, masks, guides, code books, passports, visas, clothes, compasses, and emergency gear, and blank checks. My schooling gave me no training to see myself as an oppressor, an unfairly advantaged person, or as a participant in advantaged culture. I was taught to see myself as an individual whose moral state depended on her individual moral will. At school, we were not taught about slavery in any depth. We were not taught about slaveholders as advantaged people. Slaves were seen only as a group. Slaves were seen as the only group that was deemed dehumanized. I decided to try identifying some of the daily effects of white privilege in my life. I will give you a list of special circumstances and conditions I experienced, which I did not earn, which I had to make steal or mine by birth, by citizenship, and by virtue of being a conscientious, law-abiding, normal person of goodwill. And here are a couple of the lists. There's 46 in the list. And here are a couple. I can turn on the television or open the front page of a paper and see people of my race widely represented. When I am told about our national heritage or about civilization, I am shown by the people of my color made of what it is. Whether I use checks, credit cards, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against it here for financial reliability. I do not have to educate my children to be aware of systemic racism and their own daily physical protection. I can be pretty sure that my children's teachers and employers will tolerate them if they did school and workplace more. My chief worries about them do not concern them in attitude towards their race. I can speak in public forums. I have never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group. If a traffic cop pulls me over, I can be sure I haven't been singled out because of my race. I can easily buy posters, postcards, picture books, greeting cards, dolls, toys, and children's magazines featuring people of my race. If I declare there is a racial issue at hand or there is a racial issue at hand, my race will give me more credibility from either position than a person of color. If I can choose to ignore developments in minority writing and minority activism programs, or disparage them, or learn from them. But in any case, I define ways to be more or less protected from the negative consequences of any of these choices. My culture gives me little fear about ignoring perspectives and power to people of other races. I can think over any options, social, political, imaginary, or professional, without asking whether a person of my race is accepted or allowed to do what I want to do. I can be sure that if I need legal or medical help, my race will not work against me. And so those are just some of the daily events that McIntosh experienced that showed her that her race worked for her benefit, and that people of other races didn't have the same benefits because we're part of the same group. The majority of this country is part of the same racial group, but there's a certain solidarity between us that works against people of other races. Now, our position at the affirmative is that there are legal solutions in this country that can remedy that kind of privilege. For example, in 1964, Lyndon Baines Johnson passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which made great steps in racial, which made great steps towards racial equality and towards giving people of other races and cultures, allowing them the advances and experiences that white people are able to have as well. A part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act is the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And what that did is that it allowed people who felt that they had been discriminated in the workplace to file suit under federal law, saying that I've been discriminated against. And there's also the law supports affirmative action programs, which means that work will reach out towards other, that means that workplaces reach out to find minority employees.
Process. Now we're in the process. Okay. I'll acknowledge that white privilege exists, but I'm wondering how it is that affirmative action would solve for the privilege that I feel every day when I open up the newspaper and see everyone on it with my color, or look on the TV and everybody in commercials that is consuming that product in my home. Like, how does affirmative action or the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission ever solve any of those problems or change them?
The idea behind the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and affirmative action is that we see people of our own race by virtue of their simply being more of us and us wanting to see them. And the steps that these programs take are to make proactive steps to incorporate people of other cultures into the mainstream society.
So it's an inclusionary action, right? Like, the institutions that currently exclude them now to somehow include them or incorporate them into their existing structure?
Yes, that's our claim that the law allows, that there are legal remedies allowed for the incorporation of people of other people in the mainstream society.
Okay, but these institutions have existed for a long time and have historically excluded them, or have even been erected in order to exclude them. How can they be incorporated into an institution whose very function is to exclude and discriminate against
Civil Rights Act of 1964 wasn't passed until 1964, and since then you'll notice that there have been extraordinary moves made in advancement of people of other races and cultures, and that also we may not be perfect yet, but we look to the legal system as a guide and of what to do, and that there will be steps, maybe made slowly, but as long as they're made through the system, they'll become entrenched.
So, really, how much has the legal system changed since 1964?
I mean, I don't know exact numbers or figures, but that there's been a substantial increase in the number of people, the number of non-white people who are have jobs and who are on television or in the media and who are in all aspects of society.
Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon. The affirmative team has said that the way to solve this problem in America is through legal remedy. But we, the negative team, will contend that legal remedy can never solve such a massive problem, at least not solely. We have to remember that these things that have happened in our history have not just been caused by the law, but have been caused by the attitudes of people, by the actions of individuals. And we must take this into account. The law solely cannot solve. Each individual must change their stance. I would like now to read Professor Bell Barrett from Harvard Law, a quote that he wrote on why he feels that the American legal system cannot solve this problem. What was it about our reliance on racial remedy that have prevented us from recognizing that abstract legal rights, such as equality, could do little more than bring about the cancellation of one form of discriminatory conduct that soon appeared in a more subtle, though no less discriminatory form. I would argue that we begin this rear view with a statement that many will wish to deny, but none can refute. Black people will never gain full equality in this country. Even those Herculean efforts we hail as successful will produce no more than temporary peace and progress. Short-lived victory that slides into irreverence, as racial patterns adopt in ways that maintain white dominance. This is a hard to accept fact that all history verifies. Now, Professor Bell's argument here is not that it is hopeless, but that these remedies alone cannot solve. In addition, we would also like to argue that centralizing justice on racial disparities and inequalities is insufficient, and that in America, we have to acknowledge all forms of discrimination, whether it be racial, sex, religion, whatever it be, your sexual preference, all these things must be acknowledged because they all come from the root problem of hierarchical standards in the United States. I would also like to read another quotation by my professor Bell from African American Studies and Women's Studies. And she argued, significantly, struggle to end sexist oppression that focuses on destroying the cultural basis for such domination strengthens our liberation struggle. Individuals who fight for eradication of sexism without supporting struggles to end racism or classism undermine their own efforts. Individuals who fight for the eradication of forms of group oppression, while they may maintain successful reform, their efforts will not lead to revolutionary change. Their ambient relationship is to oppression in general. It's a contradiction that we must resolve, or they will daily under-routine their own radical work. Basically, what we're saying here is that the law is insufficient. One of those reasons that the law is insufficient is the law that we, Eric Fishbone, have referred to. Only talk about certain types of discrimination. You can only file discrimination claims in five standards. They are race, sex, nationality, color, and religion. Now let's take the time to think about what this leaves out. It leaves out race discrimination based on sexual preference. It leaves out discrimination based on class, which is a huge problem in America, and yet we hear nothing about it. And it definitely needs to be addressed. Our argument here is these laws are not enough. Individuals must change their actions and their feelings. Individuals must change the way they see people and the way they interact. We need to start seeing each other as a community. And that doesn't mean that we're all exactly the same, but that means that we respect the differences that each other have. And we learn to live together without having to evaluate and put work on what a person necessarily is because of what they necessarily believe in or where their family has come from.
Five categories of race, color, religion, sex, and national origin,
then why do we need further individual change if the law itself is a guidepost for the rest of society acknowledges other forms of discrimination?
That's exactly the point. That they only see these five issues, right? And what that does is it closes our eyes to all other forms of discrimination. See, the people look to the law to tell them what is wrong in America. And when America is saying through the legal system that these are the only five things that America should worry about, then we forget about that. We forget about discrimination based on sexual preference. We discriminate by them. We forget about all these other issues.
Aren't there, but isn't that very important, Brendan? Aren't there whole ways, other forms of discrimination that we can combat and at least the legal system has to protect these five categories of people? Or protect people in playing a file suit under these five categories?
Well, I think that argument justifies not looking at it. Because when you say that what the legal system does this, why can't it do so much more?
Okay. And you said that individuals must change, that's what we need.
Yes.
Why is that? How is that?
Well, if you refer to the developer that I read, I think it made a very clear point about how you have to evaluate discrimination as a whole and not as one individual thing. Remember that if my mother or your mother were to be in a room and be discriminated against, it could be for many reasons, right? It doesn't have to be because they're female. It could be because, let's say, the person they're speaking to decides that they're in a higher class or are more knowledgeable. You know, these are all things that might affect a human being, not just race or sex.
Okay. But what about us taking our first step through the law? I mean, you'll remember how I talked about that goal. You know, it doesn't solve completely. We're a lot better off than we were since before the 64th Civil Rights Act was passed.
Well, see, I guess that depends on your outlook, right? Because it may be better for people that were discriminated against because of their race. But what about people that have been discriminated against because of their class? Like, are things better for them?
But those incremental steps towards moving there aren't good.
I believe we would have to take our own steps.
I'd like to start today with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. in the Statue of Liberty Memorial, Washington, D.C., August 28, 1963. In a sense, we have come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to hold heir. This note was a promise that all men would be guaranteed the inalienable right to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on the promissory note, insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring the sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, which has come back marking insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great wealth of opportunity in this nation. So we have come to cash this check, the check that will give us, upon the banner of riches and freedom, the security of justice. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. I have a dream that one day our nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created. I have a dream that my four children will one day live in a nation where they will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from every prodigious hilltop of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from every mighty mountain, from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from behind the heightening Allegheny, Pennsylvania. When we let freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village, from every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, free at last. Now, what I'd like to show you by this speech today is that this great man, Martin Luther King Jr., went to the steps of our Capitol, called upon them to take action, to live up to the promise and the creed of our country, that all men are free. And they did make a step. They passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that has made great strides since before this law was enacted. Now, our opponents today are saying that you can't solve these problems with the law. But is a comparative advantage not better? How do you solve the problems that exist within society? How do you solve our mindset? When the institution sets up a legal system and we are forced to work for that, as citizens of this country, how do you escape it? Where else do you go? That is why we say that you must use the legal system. You must continue to use the system. If any comparative advantage works us closer to that goal, then we can all be free. Now specifically, even by arguing to him, as he said, that you can't solve, but an individual has to take a stand. And that's what we're here to start with. To advocate these ideas, but not to abandon the institutions that exist in our society. Our voices are what are going to make the change, but ultimately, to make these a reality within our society, we still have to go through the institutions that exist. These institutions aren't just going to dematerialize. They exist, they're prior to power. There might be some flaws, but they do have them. There's no way to deny them. Now, Jared Bell, as Anthony read, said that the concept of equality is abstract. It is. There is no true way to quantify what equality is. But any step closer to that dream, that goal, is better. Now, ultimately, they said we can't focus on one type of oppression, that we must focus on all. But how do you focus on all oppression? How do you make that much of a change? How do you change people's basic belief so radically that all oppression no longer exists? That's a very difficult step. That's why things like the legal system were created, so that things such as white privilege, such as discrimination, could be dealt with in a way that was systematic. Unfortunately, you do have to break it down into categories. They are important, such as race, sex, national religion. They might exclude some categories, but ultimately, they've made our society move closer to the goal where all people can.
And you tell us that it is better to have the comparable advantage. And I ask of you, who does that to do?
The answer to all people. Because ultimately, white privilege is red. That seems to be a given. We all agree to that. But how do you make a change? Do you just get up here and talk and expect all of these people to change their minds? And just see, oh, white privilege is red. I won't do that anymore. There has to be something more than that. Our voices are powerful, but they can only go so far. Institutions exist, and so have to work through.
So this comparative advantage is for all, but what about the other men that was spoken about?
The others that are never spoken about? Discrimination, but forms of oppression. Ultimately, you have to take a step. You have to work closer to that goal. One way of doing that is to attack white privilege. Civil Rights Act of 1964 obviously made great strides towards that. They exposed that certain categories weren't covered, that more solutions are needed, and that ultimately we have to focus on. And it is a linear step. You have to go step by step if you are.
Now Peter reads a very compelling speech, one that I'm sure each of us has if not once before, probably twice, three, four, five times before. Now my question is, how long is it that we have to wait for liberation? How long do we have to wait for the system of injustice, inequality, and oppression to recognize and hear our voices? How long is it that the system is going to be silent and exclude our voices until we get heard? How long is what I want to know. Now, I'm very compelled by Martin Luther King, but at the same time, I think that maybe that ideology of seeking equality in a system whose very nature it is to build upon and exist upon inequality is not the answer anymore. He said, Peter indicates that we must take incremental steps, that the law can somehow eventually solve for problems of oppression and discrimination. But my argument would be that the law only makes us feel better. When we have the Civil Rights Act of 1964, people were effectively able to say, all right, now the law has incorporated other voices and I don't have to worry about it anymore. The law is recognizing people and that is fine now, and so all of us white people can just turn our heads and say, all right, things are fine. But how long does Anthony have to wait until the system recognizes him? He indicates that there's a comparative advantage over the status quo. I don't know if this is necessarily true. I can look around at UVM and I see about 5 black people, maybe 2 Hispanic people, and maybe like 1 Asian person for an entire year. Like that's not change. That's not incremental step. That's regression. That's making us feel as though the system has somehow changed when it hasn't. So it has the privilege and the oppression that exists in our society is only further masked now than it was before. Because of our ability to be able to say that the law is doing something. The law isn't doing anything. The law isn't changing anything. It's only making us feel better about the situation that our society is in. Moreover, that gift that has oppressed a false hope of something that is supposedly supposed to solve for them, that they can now say, all right, I won't look to my community, I won't look to my brothers and my sisters and push for change, I'll look to the system. I'm discriminated against, I'll take my case to the law. I'll sit up in front of the white judge in the lion's den and say, recognize me. But he's not going to recognize me. He's going to spit in my face. Maybe if I'm lucky, I'll win my case, but I win my case and so what? That doesn't mean I go back to work and people don't discriminate against me or my employer doesn't hire me because of my color, my sex, my sexual orientation, whatever. It just makes me what type of money makes me. And so the movement since Martin Luther King has been silent in a lull. He spoke amazing words that inspire me to this day when I hear his speech, but I don't see black people, Hispanic people, Latino people, gay, lesbian, transsexuals, out on the front doorstep of our university, parading every day to recognize privilege and oppression. That's because of our faith in the law and has effectively demobilized any movement that could ever have any hope for change. Now, the bell hook argument that Anthony read in his original speech says a couple of things. It says that when we look to eradicate racial oppression, which is what the affirmative is arguing for, and which is somehow eliminate white privilege within the law, when we do that, when we just argue that there's a problem with white privilege, we don't look to the fact that there are privileges that exist everywhere. Within the category of race, there are privileges that exist within. Black women are historically and usually discriminated against in a different way than black men. But they don't recognize that. And we don't recognize that there are interconnections between oppression and between discrimination. And so that separates us. So I can go out and I can fight for the liberation of women, and Anthony can fight for the liberation of Hispanics, but we don't ever fight together, but we don't realize, because we don't realize that we're all victims and subjects of a system of power that will continually discriminate against us unless we claim back our movement.